Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE. It's a great pleasure to welcome everyone here this afternoon, and especially to extend a particular welcome to the Prime Minister of Finland, Paavo Lipponen. We're very, very pleased that he's found time to include the LSE in his very busy schedule. Mr. Lipponen has been affiliated to the Finnish Social Democratic Party for the whole of his adult life. He was active in social democratic politics also while a student at the University of Helsinki. He's held a number of posts within the Social Democratic Party, and I shan't attempt to list them all. He was a member of the party committee between 1987 and 1990, a member of the party council between 1990 and 93. He became party chairman at the end of 1993. He's been prime minister since spring 1995, his government having been re-elected in 1999. He is here, among other things, to see Tony Blair, with whom I understand he has a very good and close working relationship. Finland has done very well under Mr. Lipponen's stewardship. Until very recently, growth levels were high. Strong economic development has been combined with an active embrace of new technologies and with effective welfare reform. GDP growth is forecast to recover to over 3% in 1993, and we hope that it does do so. The title of Mr. Lipponen's talk today is The Future of Europe, the Finnish Model. Please, having clapped him in, give him yet another clap and welcome him to the podium. Again, we're very, very pleased to have you here at the LSE.
Thank you very much, Professor Giddens, for your kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to be able to speak at this prestigious institution. I really had quite a welcome, and my wife today, we were welcomed not only by the ambassador, Finnish ambassador, but also by the prince of Kensington Gardens, that is the urban fox that has found shelter on Finnish territory, that is the Finnish residence in Kensington Gardens. And we can assure you that even if fox hunting still goes on, there will be no fox hunting on Finnish territory here. I would like to talk to you today about the Finnish experience, its relevance in European terms and even globally, about what is important in Europe and for Europe today, and the future, for the future of Europe. I would like to remind us all here that Finland has a history, and going back, of course, to the Middle Ages, Finland was first part of Sweden, which was important because we escaped feudalism. Then part of Russia for 100 years or so since the beginning of the 19th century, which also was a lucky strike for us because the nation was born, economy, and we developed the first parliament in Europe, in the world, with real universal suffrage in 1906 already. But it was also a lucky strike for us to get out of Russia in 1917 and escape the turmoil of the revolution. So the country became independent finally. All this is important in our background. And Britain has played a very important role for us. I'd like to mention here Britain's support, diplomatic support, alongside with the United States, towards the end of the Second World War, when Finland was fighting the Soviet Union, in a way having its own war. So Great Britain put pressure on the Soviet Union, Stalin, to respect Finnish independence, although the war was still going on. Actually, what was very decisive was the performance of the Finnish armed forces. That is, it was the only army that stopped the Red Army in the summer of 1944, and the only country on the continent that was participating in the war that was never occupied. Finland had a very deep economic crisis in the 1990s, actually the deepest of any Western country. Since 1995, we've had two successive rainbow coalitions, from us Social Democrats to the Conservatives, including the Greens and the party that's left of us in the Parliament. It's a broad coalition. And this government has successfully carried out fiscal consolidation, reforms, in order to save and revitalize the Finnish welfare society. And this brings us to the debate on the third way. I think our experience has some relevance for this debate, the originator of which is Professor Giddens, and it's been a major contribution, Professor Giddens' contribution, to the debate about Western and global society and its future today. So what could be interesting in the Finnish case? Really, Finland has been recently ranked in various ratings the number one country in the world in terms of economic competitiveness in the World Economic Forum ranking, in sustainable development, also in the World Economic Forum ranking, as the country with the least corruption in the world. And I will take even other examples. What is important is that we have the lowest, or the next lowest, poverty rate in Europe. It means in the world. And this success, we might say, I believe, is based both on domestic political choices and a successful adaptation to globalization. I was able to hold a press conference in New York during the World Economic Forum with Professor Jeffrey Sachs of Harvard University, a well-known, as it is said, neoliberal. Professor Sachs said that Finland has been able to organize brain power better than perhaps any other country. That is, to mobilize its human capital for growth, development, to reach this high level of internet literacy. We've got Nokia, our performance in the new economy, in the ICT sector. I think one of the fundamental factors has been openness, so that there's real exchange of information and views between, within the academic community, between research institutes, so that we can say that a small country cannot afford closed institutions. About sustainable development, the lesson from us being number one is that sustainable development does not harm economic competitiveness. On the contrary, they go hand in hand. And in the World Economic Forum assessment, both our bureaucracy, that is administration, business, Finnish business, and civic organizations get the highest marks. That is, sustainable development has been internalized in Finland. It's built in the system. So it is the innovation system based on a high level of education, openness in the research community, investment in R&D from the school system to the technology marketing that works, and also the approach that produces sustainable development. Well, Jeffrey Sachs, according to the news agency, French news agency AFP, earned a new characterization. He is no more neoliberal. He is now a social democrat. After our press conference, because in addition to what I already referred to, he said it pays to pay taxes. That is, the welfare state, the Finnish welfare state, is very efficient. It produces welfare services at a cost that is bearable. That is, although we have higher than average taxation, it still makes sense because we use our resources so effectively. I'll take an example. In the United States, the share of GDP devoted to health is twice as high as in Finland. It's about 14%. But still, I maintain that Finland's health services are better, and what's most important, they are accessible to all citizens. So this is also behind the economic performance, the welfare state. We can, of course, debate what is the future of the welfare state, but I will return to that. In addition to having an efficient educational system, I should also underline that we've got a deeply rooted policy and a society with real gender equality. We've got a well-functioning regulatory system, that is, the governance that produces development is working. Now, of course, the ICT sector, the success of the ICT sector in Finland has been highlighted. In addition to what I have reported, factors behind it, success, is early liberalization of Nordic markets, telecommunications markets, in the 80s, so that our ICT sector had already learned to become more competitive when the next stage in globalization came in the 90s. But again, I'd like to return to a basic factor. I know in Professor Giddens's books and I would say this book, The Global Third Way, is extremely interesting. So you will find really seminal contributions to the debate on the welfare state. We can characterize the Finnish model as a consensus approach. There are various kinds of models. I mean, in Britain, you've got the majority parliamentary system. You might say in Sweden, also there is not a consensus system, but a more or less one party rule. But in the Netherlands and Finland, you've got a consensus approach that has really produced economic and social progress. And in our case, cooperation between government and the labor market parties has been vital in overcoming the crisis of the 90s. It's absolutely necessary to have the support of the labor market parties in our effort to combat unemployment. But again, now we are, it's very much about the third way. Finland's emergence as a high-tech society has a key element in this has been access to foreign markets and capital. Without a larger market and without the multilateral trade system, globalization, Finland could never have developed as it has done. So it's a two-way street. It has meant bold steps in opening our own markets, allowing capital flows, and relying on multilateral institutions. Finland is a fairly satisfied member of the European Union today. So we have a very positive experience of the first 6 years of membership since the beginning of 1995. And we've also been an active member. We would like to be at the center of the debate on the future of Europe. We think that small member countries must not give any privilege to the big ones as it comes to intellectual debate on our common future. So now we are approaching a crossroads again, with enlargement coming, the convention on the future of Europe. So the next few years will be very important. And between, we have the Barcelona summit, where we should examine where we stand in terms of competitiveness globally. First and foremost, we need a successful enlargement with up to 10 new members from 2004, if possible. Secondly, we must enhance European competitiveness and prepare for an aging population and diminishing workforce. And thirdly, we need an open debate on the Europe of tomorrow, starting to define a clear set of tasks and goals for European integration. An enlarging European Union needs a reformed treaty, a restored institutional balance, and a more efficient and transparent decision-making mechanism. Above all, what is needed is a mission statement with which the citizens and businesses alike can identify with. Now, enlargement is a process that we have to complete. It's a historical process to end the division of the Cold War, to complete the reunification of Europe, is absolutely necessary. And in Copenhagen in December, the European Council meeting, we will make decisions, hopefully completing negotiations, opening the way for 10 new members. There are many problems in the negotiations. Recently, the Commission has made its proposals as to the financial framework, to structural funds support and agricultural support to the accession countries. I believe that the new financial framework will have to be based on policy reforms in the common agricultural policy and the structural funds, that is, the new framework that comes after the present one. Especially the CAP will be shaped not only by internal pressures, but also by international trade negotiations in the WTO. But it's important that we don't make reform of the CAP, other reforms, a precondition to enlargement. So, on the whole, I believe that within the framework that the Commission has proposed, we can manage to we will manage to complete the ongoing negotiations. Of course, enlargement, while it will stimulate the economy, that's a fundamental argument for it, it will also challenge the functioning of the internal market, the cohesion of the union, and also the decision-making process. So we will have to pay a lot of attention to the development of the administrative and judicial capacity and the practical implementation of internal market rules in the candidate states. And the union's decision-making process and the functioning of the institutions can be developed both by implementing the already drafted reforms and by agreeing on more radical changes in the next treaty reform in 2004. These are the challenges. But we will have to have a successful European Council at Barcelona this spring. We've had many economic successes, but we need more, especially to speed up the recovery. Europe still has a higher unemployment than our competitors. Our labor markets do not work as well as they should. The Barcelona summit must give political impetus to various new initiatives designed to improve Europe's competitiveness. Growth potential must be enhanced by continuing to reduce government deficits and to reform commodity, capital, and labor markets while investing in education and training, research and development that is needed for rapid development of the information society. Europe's fragmented financial market must be integrated by 2005. Gas and electricity markets must be fully liberalized. We cannot tolerate that European giants would be buying up companies in small countries while being protected by monopoly status. Attention should also be paid to the regulation to which small and medium-sized enterprises and indeed other companies are subjected. This regulation is important. The development of the biotechnology sector should be promoted by a better operating environment. We need legislative reforms and incentives for investments. Particularly the challenge of an aging population is daunting. There will be a shortage of labor gradually in the course of this decade in many countries. Mobility of labor within the European Union is weak. Under 2% of the working age population live in an EU country other than their own. Potential migration from new member states is unlikely to alter the situation very much. We need an immigration policy, but that alone will not solve the problem. It is most urgent that we get people to stay at work up to pension age, increase the time spent at work during their working lives, and ultimately adjust our pension benefits and social services to a situation in which the dependency ratio is far less favorable than before. This is really fundamental for the survival of the European social model, in spite of all the internal differences, to the future of our welfare state. In Finland, we are at present taking several measures to raise the employment age. In our country, the employment ratio is about 68% today. In order to be able to finance the welfare state without raising taxes, we must raise this employment ratio above 70%, actually back to the 75% that we had before the crisis. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I will say a few words about the coming debate in the Convention on the Future of the European Union. The Convention will open . The representatives have been chosen without making any remarks about what other countries, member countries, have, what kind of nominations they have made. I can tell you that the representative of the Finnish government, the Prime Minister, is a young lady from the research community. She's an expert on European integration. Her name is Teija Tiilikainen. The civil society, including the business community, must be incorporated into the process of this debate as fully as possible. Also, it's important, naturally, that European parliaments are involved. And I believe that our model for the involvement of the national parliament could serve as an example. Every Friday, the Government European Union Committee meets under the chairmanship of the Prime Minister. And in the afternoon, what is decided is reported to the Parliament European Affairs Committee. So the Finnish Parliament really controls the European policy of the government. And this means that also for the convention, the Parliament has organized itself, so there is a special subcommittee in the Finnish Parliament to follow and give instructions to the Parliament representatives to the convention. The strength of integration is based on the fact that it brings added value for all Europeans by offering equal opportunities through common rules and policies and extensive cooperation. The Union should also be an effective global political and economic actor representing the interests and potential of its member states. That's what we should achieve. The Union does need an extensive overhaul of its structures. The founding treaties must be simplified and the goals for the Union redefined. Fundamental rights of the citizens should be formally established among the guiding principles of the Union. The decision-making capacity of the Union should be strengthened, for example, by simpler legislative procedures and more qualified majority voting. The competences of the Union institutions should be more clearly defined. We need an open debate. I would like to see a convention that stimulates open debate, that produces intellectually challenging models between which we can choose. I would not like to see the mother of manipulation at this when we have such a historic opportunity. That is, that backroom manipulation would decide the result of the convention. I believe strong institutions are of fundamental importance for the Union, particularly the Commission, because actual decision-making in the Union has shown that a Commission watching over compliance with the common rules is ultimately the best guarantee against the domination of selfish and narrow national interest. Of course, the Council also must work more effectively and act as the politically controlling body for Union's policies. And there you have to identify what is in the Union's joint interest. That's where the leadership comes from when the Union strives to become a global player. We need swift decisions, transparency, and dialogue, and concrete results as the product of the European-wide political process. The ability to adapt to the rapidly changing international environment is a crucial test for the Union. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the terrorist attacks of September 11 were not only a ruthless attack on innocent human beings. It was an attack against the values on which democratic and open societies are built on, values that the European Union must defend. Europe's response to the crisis has been strong, and we have remained united. 15 member states have been able to work together with the United States and within the wider international coalition against terrorism. That is no small achievement, and we should be building on that. Military and diplomatic means are not enough to win this fight against terrorism. A lot of intelligence work and smooth international cooperation between justice and home affairs authorities is needed. There was the Tampere summit during the Finnish presidency in 1999, where the Union already began a new era in the field of justice and home affairs cooperation. Developing internal security, control of external borders, and a just asylum policy has proved difficult at times because we are dealing with issues that are close to member states' sovereignty. The goal of creating a true area of freedom, justice, and security has been strongly reaffirmed by the Union after September 11. It is now clearly understood that enhancing security in today's globalized world is a task that demands close and operational cross-border cooperation between authorities responsible for law and order. National sovereignty needs to be pooled. Our commitment to common internal policies has to be supplemented with intensified external cooperation. Cooperation with the United States is now extensive. Justice and home affairs cooperation is now a priority in our relations with Russia. The fight against terrorism has become an integral element of the European Union's foreign policy. But there's a lot more to do for us. Our citizens have justifiably expected the Union to play a key role in many aspects of global politics. The Union is the world's largest trading bloc and by far the largest provider of development aid. The Union has taken a leading role in global efforts to protect our environment, and our role has been instrumental in the Kyoto process of combating climate change. But despite these successes in different fields of external action, we still lack the coherence that would make the Union as strong a political actor as it potentially could be when we look at the Union's economic resources. Intergovernmentalism has understandably a strong foothold in common foreign and security policy. But if we are to defend the interests of the enlarging Union and play a constructive role globally, we have to pool the sovereign powers of the member states more effectively. Common institutions, and especially the Commission, should play a leading role in achieving this. As Prime Minister Tony Blair puts it, the European Union must become a superpower if it is to play a full role on the world stage. A superpower of its own kind, true to its social values and its nature as a unique community that does not primarily rely on military force in defending its interests and goals. The fight against terrorism is a good example of the need to pull the European act together. We underline the importance of human rights and the role of the United Nations in combating terrorism. We are for an even-handed treatment of the parties to the conflict in the Middle East. We have a vital interest in the stability of the Balkan region. But how much are we ready to invest in what is necessary in order to be an equal partner to the United States? Adopting a prosecution lawyer attitude towards the United States would only weaken Europe's credibility globally. The American people feel threatened. Consequently, the administration wants to continue the fight against terrorism as effectively as possible. Europe, in this situation, must play a moderating, not uncritical role, while leaving no doubt about our transatlantic solidarity. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not the last common effort. There might be more coming, with Europe needing the involvement of the United States on our continent. A super state. Here I also agree with Tony Blair. The European Union must remain a community that incorporates both sovereign states and the sovereignty that they have pooled in the Union. But as we need to assemble even more sovereignty on the Union level to mobilize our capabilities, it will become necessary to reform the institutions. Now, in the debate on the future of Europe, we usually only recognize the member states as the subjects. But now we have to recognize that it's not only the member states that are subjects, it is also the citizens and the businesses. Even some regions have a special status in the Union. We will not succeed in making the Union the most competitive economy in the world unless we can guarantee the basic equality of all citizens and businesses in the European Union. And this means that big member countries cannot have any privileges based on 19th century thinking. I have never wanted to provoke conflict between big and small member states. The real problem lies in developing a decision-making system that is based on two fundamental principles. On the one hand, the equality of member states, and on the other hand, demography, population. That is, these are objective criteria, not privilege, like being a founder member or having been a great power. With these two sets of votes, we would have a system that gives the big member countries what they deserve, what they are entitled to, and the small members the protection they need. Dear Professor, I'm aware that I'm speaking now in the Quran school of the Third Way.
Don't call it that.
I would very much like to encourage you, Professor Giddens, to continue your efforts to stimulate global debate, European debate in the first place, but also global debate on the future of the welfare state, particularly, because it's fundamental also to the debate on the future of Europe. I think there's all too little debate on the European fora, like the European Council, the summits. We have actually very little debate on the economy, on the social aspects of Europe. So the decisions are being made in a quite an incremental way in the various councils. So we really need to focus our debate so that we can also benefit from this debate in national situations like elections that we are all facing. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm ready to answer.
Prime Minister's kindly said that he'll spend a quarter of an hour answering questions. There should be roving mics around the auditorium, so why don't we start down here? Could I ask you possibly to keep your question short, given lack of time?
It's a well-known fact that the Scandinavians worship the goddess of love, Vanadis, and I think that's why the LSE has brought the Prime Minister of Rokia Land to celebrate the Valentine's Day here. It was a wonderful speech, Professor Pavalipanen. I have read in an editorial in Guardian that stating that together with the medal wealth of Russia, the Europe will really a super state. I mean, unrivaled super state. So what's your comment about this? As a Finns, you don't need to worry about your big brother like we Indians and Chinese. I got a Latvian ambassador nearby. And as an Asian, I could come to Europe as if I visited USSR. My professor of politics from Japan is here. So we all want to have a global welfare. So your comment about the Russia and the Europe, please. Yeah.
Thank you. I'd rather come from a Nokia land than from a Motorola land or Ericsson land, if you like. Well, I think President Putin and the Russian government is really committed to cooperate with Europe. Actually, when Finland was in the presidency of the European Union, I led the European Union delegation at a summit with Russia, and the Russian delegation was headed by the then Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. And he presented the first Russian strategy for cooperation with the European Union. So this goes back several years, but now there's real commitment, and particularly after September 11th. If you ask about institutional arrangement, I think we need to look at this as an evolutionary process. We've got the partnership and cooperation agreement. We can build on it, a free trade area. Russia will be a member of, hopefully, of WTO. And meanwhile, European enlargement will proceed. More or less, it's going to be a partnership, even in the future. Of course, the relationship between Russia and NATO is also evolving in parallel to this development. And that, of course, is very interesting. Also, from our point of view, what I can say is that it's also a positive development, and it means, among other things, that we will also have to see our relationship with NATO in an evolutionary way. That is, also a next step is needed in the Partnership for Peace and Euro-Atlantic Council institutional arrangements.
Let's take a question from up the top. Can you wait until the microphone? Is there a microphone? Someone over the right-hand side there. Why don't you start shouting and the microphone will come.
Do you think that there is a European identity?
Good question. I've been studying the last few months history of the Middle Ages, and I see Europe emerging already at the time of Charlemagne, but I also see a sort of a Western civilization. It all goes back to the Roman Empire and Greece and actually the common roots of human civilization. So I think this is special about European identity, that we can't actually separate it from its historical roots. But I think I believe on what I said in my lecture, particularly the social model, tolerance, European identity will develop. It's not that we should become a military superpower. That's not the way.
Do you have another question from upstairs at all? On the left-hand side there. Why don't you start shouting as well?
There was an article recently from the New York Times that talked about the tremendous influence...
Microphone's got to you.
Oh, thank you. I'll start again.
There was an article recently in the New York Times that talked about the large influence that Nokia has within the Finnish economy. I'd be curious, on your opinion, whether, one, you find a problem that one firm presents such a large part of a successful Finnish economy, and two, if you think that is a problem, what measures you think need to be taken in order to further diversify the Finnish economy?
Well, I think the article was a little, I mean, an example of the type of arrogance that we see in big country media. that Finland, what's Finland? I mean, it must be Nokia, not Finland. doesn't have anything to do with things Finnish. But I think, I hope I've been able to convince you that there's really a long historical development behind this and all the efforts we've made, like the government already, the Finnish government in the beginning of the 80s decided to raise the R&D spending from 2.2% of GNP. And my previous government decided to raise it from 2.2 to 3.2. It's 3.5 now, this year. So we're on top with Sweden, number one in this respect. Naturally, we have been concerned about the effects of Nokia. But we've seen that during this recession that we've had in the world economy, the Finnish economy has fared quite well. That is, employment has still been going up, and of course, the way that Nokia has been led has been part of the success, the secret. But again, there's something Finnish in it. I mean, the prudent kind of management concerning taking new employees, responsible way of dealing with these questions, and openness within the management and openness about the company itself outwards, and while we have developed this innovation system, so we are building new feet for our economy, and the next one is biotechnology. We have some world top research institutions. Helsinki is one of the real centers in the world. And then further foot will be media design industries. And that also is really developing now. So we are well aware of the need to diversify the economy.
A question in the middle up top there, and we'll come to someone at the bottom. Can you speak up a bit more than that?
In response to a welfare state aging population, what is your response to
abolishing national military service to increase the average time of the males spend in the workforce? Would this such an abolishment be part of the future Finnish model?
We've got a military defense system that's based on mobilization of today 450,000 in case of war, in 10 years 350,000. We've got universal military service. I believe it's one of the factors that support equality. I mean, of course, it's men, but even women can serve today. That is, that people from all men, young men from all kinds of backgrounds, come together. That's a factor for equality. But it's naturally a defense system. Our defense system is very effective. It costs less than in most other countries. That is 1.5% of GNP we spend in terms of military spending. So that means that we can use those resources for other purposes like education, R&D. We have now changed the system of service so that people serve from 6 to 12 months, so there's flexibility. And the training you get, if you serve 12 months, is good. I mean, it gives you greater competence when you continue your education or in working life. But the problem is there in Finland, that is, it takes too long a time from school to university and from university or higher education to work. So this is a problem, and we have to tackle it in order to raise the employment ratio. But I don't see the military service as a central problem here.
I think we've got time for a couple more questions. Anyone down here like to ask one?
Yes, the final.
Do you have a specific answer to the challenge posed by the anti-globalization movement?
Well, I think the debate has progressed a little so that we now have more debate on what kind of globalization instead of for or against globalization. And Professor Giddens has made a very, very important contribution to this debate. So I believe that it's going to be more intellectual debate instead of throwing stones from now on. But naturally, it takes from the governments a more positive attitude towards the criticism. And for us Europeans, it's of course the European Union that is our instrument in tackling the challenges of globalization. So let us concentrate on making the European Union an even more effective instrument and influencing the policies of the European Union through our governments, through the democratic process. I think it is entirely possible. But again, I must say that we need more debate, open debate. We need fora where also the critics and the establishment, so to speak, can meet. And I'm absolutely ready to engage in this.
Can I have one more question from upstairs? On the left hand side there, or the right hand side.
Good afternoon. The question concerns the expansion of the European Union towards East. We know that Finland is net contributor towards the European Union budget, and of course in the near future, by expansion of the European Union, it will represent extra burden to the taxpayers in Finland. How do you personally feel about that, and what do people in Finland think about that issue?
Well, we are in the process of trying to estimate the additional cost that enlargement will bring to us. It will be considerable, but in my opinion, tolerable. That is, we will be much more of a net contributor. Of course, we must also recognize that among the net contributors, there must be more fairness. I'm thinking, for example, of Germany. So we will need reforms, for example, in the CAP. But I think that people will accept, first of all, the need for the Union to enlarge, for Europe to be reunited, and in our case particularly, it is the Baltic states that we are thinking of. That is that our neighbors, the small countries, they must be included in the European family. They've got the right. And we must not, us being able to become members, we can't think of, in the United States, that the latest incoming ethnical group is the biggest enemy of the next incoming group. We can't think it this way. That's the historical part. And the other argument is that we are competitive. The enlarging market, internal market, we can benefit from it in terms of bigger growth, more opportunities for our also small and medium-sized companies. So I believe the performance and the success in the Finnish economy will give us the necessary self-confidence to take on enlargement. Thank you.
Because of Mr. Lippman's schedule, that has to be the last question. So can I ask you for the moment all to stay in your seats until the Prime Minister has left the lecture theatre, and meantime, please give him a good hand for having come and spoken to us at the LSE.